Welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, November 20th, 2022. I'm your reader, Sharon Faldrudo, and from the front page of today's Gazette, Jefferson alum leads organization backing Cedar Rapids School Bond. Our kids are worth us investing in these schools, by Grace King of the Gazette. A yes committee to rally support from voters for the Cedar Rapids Community School District's proposed $312 million bond referendum will be led by Scott Drzymski, a Jefferson High alum and parent to children in the district. Drzymski, Director of Public Affairs at ITC Midwest, an electricity transmission company based in Cedar Rapids, believes students and educators in the Cedar Rapids district deserve safe and equitable learning spaces. The Yes Committee, which is looking for members, is a grassroots effort to educate residents about the plan and encourage them to vote, Drzymski said. I'm not sure there's ever a perfect time to ask voters to support a bond issue by raising their taxes, Drzymski said, but I'm afraid if we wait, we might miss an opportunity and we don't make this any cheaper for the community long term. One of my favorite sayings is the best time to plant a tree was 20 years ago, and the second best time is right now, he said. All of us have costs and the challenges of meeting rising bills, but I think our kids are worth investing in these schools. The Cedar Rapids District's general obligation bond issue, if approved, would fund a 7 to 10 year plan to improve secondary schools, which includes building a new aquatic center to replace the 3 pools in the district's high schools and a new 1,200 student middle school. The school board is expected next month to approve a timeline for the plan, including taking a bond referendum to district voters in September. The committee will conduct polling in the community to gauge how residents feel about the plan, even going door-knocking to get information to residents and answer questions, Drzymski said. The group will raise funds and reach out to potential donors, he said. One of the main goals of the district's plan is to reduce the number of middle schools in the district from 6 to 4 and provide more equitable services to all students. This would create a feeder system from middle school to high school, and it would reduce operational and maintenance costs for the districts, Director of Operations John Galbraith said in a school board meeting last week. Anyone interested in joining the Yes Committee can contact Drzymski by emailing him at futurereadyschoolscr@gmail.com. Wilson Middle School Principal Mike Waters said the age and size of some of the district's middle schools present real challenges. Under the proposal, Wilson Middle School at 2301 J Street Southwest may be demolished and a new building built on the site. Wilson is a beautiful building, there's no denying that, Waters said. The architecture is great. We had only one broken window during the derecho because a branch fell into it. Other than that, it was damage-free. What also is true is that it is wildly ineffective as an educational institution in 2022. There is only one section of each class at Wilson isolating teachers who don't have peers in the building to help bounce ideas off of and problem solve. I have one teacher per subject, Waters said. That means one sixth grade math teacher who doesn't have anyone to talk to about how to be a better sixth grade math teacher. She can talk to other sixth grade teachers or other math teachers, but she has no one to talk to about sixth grade math. Waters believes the district is losing out on qualified teachers for this reason. Candidates often ask about who they will have the opportunity to collaborate with. Larger schools mean more teachers who can be in professional learning communities, working to improve and in turn improve learning outcomes for students, Waters said. The $312 million bond referendum proposed in Cedar Rapids would be the largest school bond request to be put forward in the state. The Cedar Rapids district has not put a bond issue on the ballot in more than 20 years. If the bond is approved, the debt service portion of the district's property tax levy, which currently is zero, would increase to $2.70 per $1,000 of taxable valuation. For example, the owner of a house assessed at $200,000 would see a tax increase of about $23 per month, or about $280 per year for 20 years, according to board documents. In Iowa, school board issues, basically loans that schools take out typically for 10, 15, or 20 years, require a supermajority of 60% of voters to pass. In passing bond issues, voters agree to repay the loan, with interest, through their property taxes. School districts, by law, cannot take a position on bond referendums. They can provide the facts about a bond vote and ask residents to vote, but the promotion and advocacy for the proposals comes from Vote Yes committees of residents. Also from the front page, it's official, 3 Ukrainian boys join Hiawatha family, by Elijah Decius of the Gazette. After speaking their truth for more than three tumultuous years, Jenna and Scott Breckenridge finally heard it echoed back to them at the Linn County Juvenile Justice Center. "It's my honor this year, domestically, to tell you officially in the state of Iowa that you are the parents of these three boys," said Judge Nicholas Scott, the final authority on the matter. The Friday hearing finalizing their adoption was perhaps faster than usual. Twins Ilya and Bogdan, 17, had to sign consent forms confirming their adoption was being made without coercion or undue influence. They signed the papers before the judge could even finish giving the short instructions for them to make their final decisions. After 39 months wading through preposterous hurdles, they refused to waste another minute. "I know you're going to have great lives here and do great things," he told the three Ukrainian-born twins and their brother, Mykola, 12. "Now Americans, their new birth certificates will reflect what they've known in their hearts since they laid eyes on Jenna and Scott, the Breckenridge last name." And with that weight off their shoulders, the parents were able to say something else for the first time. "Finally, it's done," Scott said to family gathered after the hearing. The court hearing was in some ways a formality that could never change the family's bond, but the recognition afforded by the finalization has given Ilya, Bogdan, and Mykola the legitimacy of their family name. Before they hosted the twins, Jenna and Scott never actually talked about adopting, but once Ilya and Bogdan walked through the airport terminal doors, it was a done deal as far as they were concerned. The boys had been passed over several times during selections for host trips to the United States in their time at the Ukrainian orphanage. By the second day of their visit to Iowa, the twins were calling the Breckenridges Mom and Dad. "Every quality about Jenna and Scott is what makes them parents," Bogdan said. "When I came here, I knew they would be my parents," he said. Through Ukrainian bureaucracy riddled with corruption, chasing paper trails, and nearly missing critical deadlines after rejected applications, Scott and Jenna gripped onto hope, prayers, and a tenacious persistence through what appeared to be insurmountable hurdles to adopt the boys. Last year, Jenna spent several months living in Ukraine to work through the country's legal processes, during which time she met Mykola and finished the process for his adoption, too. She contended with suspicion from a judge who thought she wanted to adopt Mykola to harvest his organs for her other children, but the authenticity of their bond was undeniable. "She couldn't believe we wanted to adopt him because of his special needs," Jenna previously told the Gazette. "They shun these kids in this country." Those special needs were a simple cleft palate and developmental delay. Mykola, then 11, had spent almost his entire life in an orphanage after his biological mother left him at the hospital as a baby. If they hadn't been adopted by parents fighting to bring them home, Bogdan and Ilya said they would be on the front lines of Ukraine's fight against the Russian invasion and possibly dead by now. After aging out of their Mariupol orphanage system, they lived in a hostel for months as they awaited the legal adoption process. With few career prospects to bide their time, they almost joined the military. Mariupol fell to Russian control in May. Asked about his future plans, of which he has many, Bogdan chose to focus on the gravity of the moment Friday at court. "I don't care what's happening tomorrow," he said. "What's happening today is what I care about." The Breckenridges are a prime example of how difficult international adoptions can be. After sacrificing time, finances, mental and emotional energy, they hope others can learn from their experience. Of all the stressful experiences, their worst pain was being separated from the twins for nearly 2 years, perhaps the true mark of a parent. "Don't be scared. Dive in," Scott said. "You're always going to have excuses, a reason to say no. We had a million reasons we could have said no." "I'm not saying it's easy," said Jenna, now a de facto adoption advocate, "but it's worth it." The parents continue to fight to adopt Artem, a fourth Ukrainian teenager. After Russia seized control of his city, the 15-year-old escaped to Italy, where he lives with other orphans. His adoption remains in limbo, as most adoptions are not being processed by Ukraine's Ministry of Social Policy, while the country remains under martial law. From Iowa Today, Coral Ridge Bucks Trends of Some Iowa Shopping Malls by Aaron Jordan of the Gazette. It's beginning to look a lot like mall season. Coral Ridge Mall, a 24-year-old retail center near Interstate 80 in Coralville, welcomed new clothing stores and a candy shop this fall. And Planet Fitness is under construction and expected to open in January. "That's kind of the whole direction of malls, making it an entertainment and shopping destination," Coral Ridge General Manager Monica Hiles said. "Retail, fitness, and making it a one-stop shop." The mall is 97% occupied, bucking a trend among some Iowa malls. One of its anchor tenants, Yonkers Department Store, closed in 2018 when the company went out of business. But in 2019, a new anchor was found for the space, Ashley Home Store. One strategy, Hiles said, is attracting national and international stores, such as H&M, which opened last year at Coral Ridge, and local entrepreneurs who want to try bricks and mortar retail. A lot of times what we do for local tenants is we start them on a kiosk or on a short-term lease so they can start their business and incubate it, Heil said. If it's successful, we grow them into a larger space on a permanent basis. An example of this is the Black and Gold Shop, which started as a kiosk, then moved to a satellite building outside Coral Ridge Mall when its business grew, Heil said. For November and December, Black and Gold also will have a store in the mall. Other new stores include Lolly and Pops, which sells everything from gourmet cotton candy and gummies to macarons and fancy chocolates. The store opened November 4th by Hellsburg Diamonds near the mall's center court. Bring your sweet tooth because there's something in there for everybody, Heil said. Daily Thread, a new women's clothing store near Dillard's, has the motto of affordable fashion every day, Heil said. Planet Fitness is taking over the space of several former storefronts, moving into the area south of Barnes & Noble where Chico's, Ragstock, and Hallmark had been. The New Hampshire-based fitness chain will have only exterior entrance. They are under construction right now, she said. They are hoping to be open around the first of the year to get all the New Year's resolutions. Planet Fitness opened a location last year at Lindale Mall in Cedar Rapids, and it also has a gym in the Iowa City Marketplace on the east side of Iowa City. Ragstock, a Minneapolis-based chain that sells vintage and recycled clothing, moved to a bigger store on Coral Ridge's main concourse by Bath & Body Works. Hallmark, the greeting card and gift retailer, also upgraded to a larger store, moving to the former Pier 1 store outside the mall. Santa will be arriving at Coral Ridge at 11 a.m. November 25th. For the first time in the mall's history, the jolly old elf and his photo-taking crew will be in the mall food court rather than the center of the mall, Heil said. Santa will be there until Christmas Eve. The Week in Iowa, a recap of news from across the state under the heading In the News, House Republicans and Education Reform Committee. Iowa House Republicans are adding an Education Reform Committee in the upcoming legislative session. The measure comes as Governor Kim Reynolds is expected to continue a push to shift millions in taxpayer dollars to private school tuition assistance. The committee will deal with bills containing significant reforms to our education system, Republican House Speaker Pat Grassley, who will chair the committee, said. Legislators also considered bills in this year's session that would require schools to post course materials online and prohibit obscene material from school libraries. Iowans weigh in on Trump presidential bid. Iowa politicians endorsed by former President Donald Trump kept him at arm's length after he announced a third run for president last week. Senator Chuck Grassley and Representative Ashley Hinson both said they encourage all candidates to come to Iowa to make their pitch to voters ahead of the 2024 Republican caucuses. Trump is the first Republican to announce his candidacy for 2024, but several others, including former members of his cabinet, have been testing the waters for presidential campaigns and were frequent visitors to Iowa ahead of the midterms. A Des Moines Register Mediacom Iowa poll from October found that 52% of Iowans said their feelings toward Trump are mostly unfavorable. Senators split on marriage bill. Republican Iowa U.S. Senators Joni Ernst and Chuck Grassley were split in a vote Wednesday on a vote to advance a bill that would codify same-sex marriage and interracial marriage at the federal level. Ernst voted for the proposal, while Grassley voted against it, citing religious liberty concerns. The motion to invoke cloture and proceed to a vote passed the Senate with support from 12 Republicans, including Ernst. Senators included an amendment that ensures nonprofit religious organizations will not be required to provide services or accommodate a same-sex marriage. Scott County finishes hand recount. A recount of ballots in Scott County ended Friday and flipped the results of the race for Iowa House District 81. Craig Cooper, a Democrat, had 5,093 votes, a slim 6-vote lead over the 5,087 votes for Republican Luanna Stoltenberg. On election night, Stoltenberg had the lead by 29 votes, 5,062 to 5,033. Final results will be canvassed. A 470-ballot discrepancy discovered in absentee ballot numbers prompted the recount. Under the heading, They Said, I'm honored my colleagues have trusted me to lead the RGA as we work to ensure voters in Louisiana and Kentucky are given that same chance at a better future and Mississippi gives Governor Tate Reeves the second term he's earned, Republican Governor Kim Reynolds, after being elected chair of the Republican Governors Association. Iowans don't care if a new committee in the Iowa legislature is created to consider the governor's voucher plan or other bad ideas like jailing teachers and banning books because it's just all politics. Democratic House Leader Jennifer Confst on the new Education Reform Committee. Under the heading Odds and Ends, agencies manage infrastructure cash. Last week marked a year since the passing of the federal infrastructure law, which dedicated over $1 trillion to projects across the country dealing with road maintenance, airports, waterways, broadband, and more. The law resulted in a 30% increase in the Iowa Department of Transportation's five-year project plan, allowing local governments to fund more improvement projects on Iowa's roads and bridges. Iowa's airports have received $51 million, and more than $113 million has been dedicated to Iowa's drinking water safety. Kim Reynolds leads Republican governors. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds will lead the Republican Governors Association after being elected to the post this past week. Reynolds, who handily won re-election November 8th, previously was vice chair of the organization. Reynolds will lead the group's fundraising efforts as it looks to elect GOP candidates in 2023 governor elections in Kentucky, Louisiana, and Mississippi. Under the heading Water Cooler, COVID hospitalizations drop. Iowa COVID-19 cases ticked up slightly in the week ending Wednesday with 1,980 new cases compared to 1,863 the previous week. The number of people hospitalized in the state with the virus dropped in the same period from 180 to 137. Google settles with states. Iowa will be paid more than $6 million in a multi-state settlement over Google's location tracking practices. The tech giant settled for $391.5 million with 40 states this past week, the largest tech security settlement with states in U.S. history. And legislative Dems elect leaders. Iowa House Democrats re-elected Representative Jennifer Konst of Windsor Heights as House Minority Leader and Representative Lindsey James of Dubuque as Minority Whip last weekend. This past week, Senate Democrats re-elected Senator Zach Walls of Coralville to be Minority Leader and elected Senator Sarah Trone-Garriott of West Des Moines as Democratic Whip. Turning to the Insight page, a guest column from Derek Muller, a nationally recognized expert in election law at the University of Iowa College of Law, where he studies and teaches about the role of states in the administration of federal elections. In late October, he submitted an amicus brief to the U.S. Supreme Court on a case that could drastically reshape U.S. elections, addressing the independent state legislature theory. But Mueller doesn't just understand election law from an ivory tower perch. On election day, he was a precinct chair in Iowa City, running a polling station inside the University of Iowa. Conversation U.S. asked him to reflect on what it's like to be both an election law scholar and an election worker. Question: You occupy a pretty high place in the world of election law scholars, but here you are participating at the most basic level in an election and in our democracy. Answer: I've worked as a poll worker several times in California and in Iowa. It's just a remarkable opportunity to see boots on the ground, what the effects of the law can be in the day-to-day administration of an election, and it's a very practical way of giving back to the community and participating in a way that can help voters at the most important points of their contact with the democratic process. Question: Did you see anything different this election from previous ones you've worked? Answer: Turnout was higher than 2020 in Iowa, but that was an off-year election. I think there's been a return to in-person voting in a lot of places, whether that's because of COVID-19 or whether that's because of changes to absentee ballot rules like those in Iowa, it's not clear. Otherwise, it was pretty typical of how I've seen the elections run in the county before. Question: What was your precise job? Answer: As precinct chair, my responsibility is to make sure that I contact the other precinct election officials who are working the day. I collect the supplies the night before that we're going to need for the election. I help set up and organize the precinct ahead of the polls opening and assign people to different functions. I troubleshoot any problems that arise from the other officials. We had an election observer in the room at all times from one of the parties, so they check in with me. If there were problems I couldn't solve, then it was up to me to contact our rover, essentially a supervisor, who roves across six different precincts, or the county auditor's office if other problems arose. Question: Did you get any sense from voters what they were thinking about? Answer: Occasionally, some people made comments about the process because they were frustrated if they didn't have the right ID or their ID was expired. And then there are the other people who are really excited. It's their first time voting, they want to have a selfie, or they're really excited about how easy the process is. Or they're really grateful that these workers are spending 15 hours sitting there. So you get a range of statements from voters. I think people are always pleased to do their civic duty. They're enthused to get a sticker and head out the door. Question: Was there something you saw that might inform your work as a scholar, or something that your scholarship informed in terms of what you did there? Answer: I see how election officials have discretion, how the way they phrase things can have an effect on the voters. If somebody doesn't have the right proof of residency, for instance, it's kind of discretionary what an election official does. Do you say, if you can go home and find your proof of residency and bring it in, that would be great. We'd love to get you registered today so we can have the opportunity for you to vote, but you know there's only 2 hours left in the polls being open. Or do you say, I don't think you're going to be able to get home and find that and get back, so we can have you cast a provisional ballot. But if you encourage that, they might fill that ballot out and never come back to cure it, so their vote won't count. You're trying to provide opportunities for voters to consider things that really give them a choice without driving them into a direction that can skew the decision-making. That's really hard. Question: in that interaction, you have the power to make their vote more or less likely to count. Answer: yes. On the other side, as a scholar doing this election day work, I realize that we have these laws that we write and think they make sense until they play out on the ground, and then election officials are supposed to juggle things. Question: can you give us an example? Answer: you have the statutes on the books about proof of residency. For instance, if you're trying to establish residency on election day, you need a utility bill or cell phone bill. But questions arise where somebody who wants to vote says, I have this statement from the university to my home address billing me for services, or I have a health care bill or a heating bill. Do those things count? You don't have a lot of guidance there, and you're trying to make your best judgment call. Question: in late October, you submitted an amicus brief to the Supreme Court on the independent state legislature's theory. Less than 2 weeks later, you're sitting at a table signing in voters. What's that like? Answer: I like both. Writing academic works and articles is important. Writing big idea amicus briefs to the Supreme Court is important, and I'm honored to have done a little bit of that. I don't know that I've had as much influence on others have had, but we'll see what the Supreme Court has to say. But there's no better way of seeing how these laws play out in the voting process than seeing it at the ground level. We have all these ideas about how elections work, but you can't understand the law's implications until you get there and see a lot of volunteers, a lot of senior citizens or retirees who are participating in running the process. And then there's the added benefit of working in my community. Question: did the political maelstrom in the rest of the country affect your polling places in Iowa? Answer: in places like Arizona, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, or Michigan, there was just a lot of heat, rhetoric, and a lot of energy spent by Republicans talking about the election process and the election system. And that trickled into the primaries in those states and in other states where there are senators or governors on the ballot. In Iowa, you didn't have people who are openly questioning our election process. Question: what about recent concerns about many election officials coming from a partisan background? Answer: working with election officials, including our auditor in Johnson County, you learn how professional these officials and their staff are and the care and attention they put into their work year in and year out to make these things run smoothly. They don't want problems. There can be consequences for poorly run elections. People might not want you to serve in that job again. In Iowa, they do a really good job of having bipartisan balance on every precinct. Whenever there's anything involving tabulation of ballots, there's always a bipartisan team at every precinct who's involved in that. They do a good job of trying to eliminate some of the politics from the process. I think for the most part, election officials want the election to run as smoothly as possible, and they're doing everything they can to that end. In Althea Cole's To a Candid World column, she writes, "Stressed out by elections? Get involved in them." The New York Times shared some tips on election day for readers to manage their stress over the elections. They were interesting. Counting backward from 100 was one. Breathe like a baby, or expanding one's belly while breathing to boost oxygen levels to the brain, was another. My favorite tip, judging by how hard I rolled my eyes at least, was take a deep breath and then plunge your face into a bowl or sink filled with ice water. For severe, clinically diagnosed anxiety, such measures are probably pretty helpful. For election-related stress, they seem a bit excessive. Yet they were shared in earnest, with the kicker that elections and anxiety often go hand in hand. 2/3 of American adults, according to the American Psychological Association, said that the 2020 U.S. presidential election was a significant source of stress in their lives, as reported by the Times. Granted, that was 2020, but the point seems to remain, not just in 2022, but likely beyond. Election season anymore turns some people into a bundle of nerves. Elections do not have that effect on me. That's not to say that they don't cause me stress. Combined with my work for this publication, my work as an early voting official, which I've written about extensively, made for some exhausting 60-hour work weeks. But does campaign rhetoric cause me worry? Do I fret about the results of the races? Does the impending doom of our political civilization keep me up at night? No. I've noticed that those who indeed experience that type of election-related stress are the ones who invest so relatively little of their own time and effort into the political process. They cast their votes, sure, but the rest isn't so much participation as it is consumption. They consume their news and commentary outlets of choice. They bury themselves in their social media feeds, sharing and reacting to every post about how the other side is stupid and horrible and a threat to our rights. They watch every debate, not to discern between candidates, but to root their chosen side on. Elections are by and large a spectator sport, but instead of bragging rights, victory means salvation instead of destruction. If my team wins, they'll save the country. If it loses, the other team will destroy it. Talk about a high-stakes, zero-sum game. No wonder some people apparently can't deal with it. So we retreat. Civics and politics are now two separate subjects. Many of us let our disgust with the latter preclude our participation in the former. It's a shame because the best way to channel that anxiety is, believe it or not, to actually participate in the election process. My own experience, volunteering for political causes over the last decade, tells me so. I found out pretty quickly that involvement in the process allowed me to replace these feelings of disdain and resentment with a sense of ownership in the process, win or lose. And losing happens. Almost all of the candidates I supported with my volunteer efforts that first year in 2012, from the bottom of the ticket to the top, lost. Yes, I volunteered for the Mitt Romney campaign. Yes, of course, I can laugh at that. I tried to convince myself that election night that our country was doomed, but the sun rose the next morning and life went on. Like any good athlete or community leader will tell you, there is more to be learned from losing than winning. A dose of humility is like a plateful of cruciferous vegetables. It doesn't taste very good, but it plays a role in optimal health. Losses are painful, but invaluable to tempering our expectations. Over the last 10 years, I've seen more than one candidate run a very good race, posting impressive fundraising numbers, canvassing thousands of households, connecting personally with voters, and performing well in debates, only to come up short. It's an important and helpful thing to understand, regardless of one's level of involvement in the campaigning process. Sometimes voters just see things a different way. Win or lose, if a candidate and their supporters want voters to see things their way, they must find those voters and talk to them. Political involvement has a way of forcing a person out of their echo chamber, for no votes are to be earned by talking only to those who already think and vote like them. When asking for the support of a potential voter, one must be able to articulate to that voter why they should vote for their candidate. Suddenly, political engagement becomes less about playing for a team and more about engaging on issues that matter. Politics isn't so bad when it's a friendly face at one's doorstep instead of the 100th TV ad with unflattering photos and ominous background music. Sometimes my candidates win. Yes, it feels good, but sometimes winning isn't everything. In fact, winning isn't anything if those who win neglect the wishes of those who elected them. One of the most enlightening periods of my political involvement happened right after the 2014 election, when my team, the evil Republicans, flipped a few big seats at both the federal and state level. I was enjoying participating in the process and wasn't ready to pick up my ball and go home, so I pivoted from advocating for candidates to advocating for policy. During the 2015 legislative session, that meant opposing a 10-cent increase to the state fuel tax under what the organization I was volunteering for saw as a hollow promise of fixing roads. It also meant that I would find myself at odds with some of the very people I had campaigned for only months earlier. It turns out that the political process involves a whole lot more after election day than it does before. I learned several valuable lessons during that failed attempt to convince legislators to not increase the gas tax that year. The first, some but not all voters will gladly let their government tax them if they believe it's for fixing roads and bridges. The second, many of the same people who refuse to engage their legislators before they take up an important issue will not hesitate to condemn them afterward when they feel let down. Last, yes, your elected officials will at some point let you down, especially if you are oblivious to the process by which they operate. Most people know who represents them in Washington, but do we know who represents us in Des Moines, on our city councils, our local boards of supervisors? If we do not engage with our representatives in government at every step throughout the process, then how can we be surprised when they make those decisions without us? We have a guest column from Bruce Lear, who is connected to public schools for 38 years, taught for 11 years, and represented educators as an Iowa State Education Association regional director for 27 years. Bruce Lear writes, "Red tide dangerous for public schools." A red tide can be deadly for ocean swimmers. An electoral red tide can drown the idea of bringing Iowa back to the middle and can be especially dangerous for public school educators and the health of Iowa public schools. November 8th brought a red wave that swamped all but one Democratic statewide office holder and washed more Republicans into both chambers of the Iowa legislature. The red tide didn't cause a national wave, but Iowa didn't get the memo. MAGA has no middle, and that's the danger. Elections have consequences, and this one is no exception. When the Republicans gained the majorities in 2016 and Terry Branstad occupied Terrace Hill, the GOP leadership promised to kick down doors to pass our agenda. This time around, with what they perceive as a huge mandate, they won't stop with kicking in doors. They'll light the house on fire. Last session of the legislature, public education and teachers were the target for any Republican legislator who wanted to make his or her MAGA bones. For that reason, I'm predicting the GOP majorities and the governor will punch down again on educators by ramming through three priorities early, much like they did when they destroyed public sector bargaining in 2017. Governor Kim Reynolds won by 19 points and had long coattails. She's made no secret her priority is passing a sweeping private school voucher plan. She won't waste time. While Iowans are hungover from Christmas cheer, she'll be working to pass her priority. She may not have enough votes yet, so I predict she'll add sweeteners for her third attempt. Those sweeteners will be aimed at rural Republican legislators who rebelled the first two times by refusing a yes vote. I think Reynolds may try three different approaches. First, she'll propose more money as a backfill if rural schools lose students to private schools. That means dipping into the sacred $1.9 billion state surplus, courtesy of Joe Biden and the Democrats in Congress. Second, she may allow parents already paying for private school to grab some voucher cash. Third, she'll add paying homeschool parents a voucher to forego both public and private school and instead educate their kids around the kitchen table. No matter the enhancement, public schools lose and rural areas become education deserts with an underfunded public school and no private school within driving distance. Another early move will be bills to lower the requirements for becoming a teacher. This will be the GOP's fix to address the teacher shortage instead of recognizing there's simply a shortage of professionals willing to get bashed every day for a less than professional salary. Look for GOP legislative eyes turning to Arizona and Florida, where new teachers don't need a college degree. Within 30 days of the beginning of the session, funding for schools will be debated. Look for the GOP majorities to have amnesia about that $1.9 billion carryover balance they bragged about during the election. Because of tax cuts and the exemptions for retiree pensions, state revenue is declining. That means schools will again be underfunded at far less than the rate of inflation. These predictions are not inevitable. Educators need to join the Iowa State Education Association, attend forums, and develop bipartisan relationships with legislators. Every decision concerning the classroom is political. Educators need to tell their stories and hold politicians accountable. Iowa must find the political middle again in both parties. That's where the state thrives, and our public schools are the solid foundation. Today's editorial comic is from editorial cartoonist Joe Heller, who is based in Green Bay. We have a man with a beard and a Santa hat on his head. He's standing next to a tree with a box labeled decorations and some Christmas lights at his feet. He's holding a paper that says shopping list. He says, ho, 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 it's never too early for Christmas. And what appears to be his wife and a young child. The wife says, Grandpa's gone from being an election denier to being a Thanksgiving Day denier. The first letter is from Dan Myers of Cedar Rapids. Trump-backed hopefuls' wins are no surprise. Apparently, Donald Trump's glowing endorsement of Senator Chuck Grassley and Governor Kim Reynolds in Sioux City on November 3rd didn't have the same impact on Iowa's voters as it did in other parts of the nation on Election Day. Those of us who can still remember when our elected officials worked in partnership with their colleagues across the aisle for the betterment of our state and nation can be thankful for the fact that his hands-on involvement, whether unwelcome or not, somehow managed to successfully preserve our democracy for at least another couple of years. The theme, Too Liberal for Iowa, in the Grassley, Marionette Miller Meeks, and Ashley Hinson ads down the stretch shouldn't have come as a surprise. After all, that faction's ancestors used to say the same thing about Henry Ford and Thomas Edison back in the day. I trust that last Tuesday's voters who still drink from wells and burn coal and candles that live outside Polk, Linn, Johnson, and Story counties are quite pleased that their ultra-conservative candidates emerged victorious. Dan Myers of Cedar Rapids. Next, Donna Silver Hops of Ely writes, Christmas Sunday services are important. I was dumbstruck recently to learn that there will be churches closed on Christmas Day because it falls on a Sunday this year. For those churches not having a service on Christmas Sunday, what excuse is good enough to cancel celebrating the birth of Christ on a day that is designated by this country as one of our two most holy days? What if Jesus had canceled his coming 2,000 years ago? What if he had told his father, I don't feel like going to earth. I don't really want to do this. I want to stay home here in heaven where I can be with my heavenly family. Besides, 33 years after I'm born, those humans will torture and crucify me by the most despicably cruel death invented. They just aren't worth it to me. I vote to cancel this plan to save mankind. Celebrating a child's birthday is an important family occasion for most. Celebrating the birth of Christ for believers should be an even bigger, more inclusive family celebration when Christmas actually coincides with Sunday. Church doors should be open to give all who wish to celebrate Jesus' birth on Christmas Sunday. It should never be considered an inconvenience or just another holiday off from work. Isn't Jesus worthy of at least 1 hour on his special day, or has the world succeeded in secularizing yet another part of the Christian church? Donna Silver Hops of Ely. Next, Tim Countryman of Cedar Rapids writes, endorsements show Gazette is out of touch. The front page of the Gazette on November 10th offered interesting insight into where the Gazette is and isn't. The top headline of the day stated Grassley Reynolds were win nearly all counties, and yet the Gazette endorsed the opponents of both of those for positions. Better evidence that the Gazette is completely out of touch with a majority of Iowans has rarely been so vividly portrayed. Good job, Gazette. Good job. Tim Countryman of Cedar Rapids. Steve Holmes of Iowa City writes, "Don't tread on me either, Republicans." How the GOP sees the world. Require a person to wear a mask in public health crisis? Tyranny. Force a woman to give birth after rape? That's okay. Who's really getting treaded on here? Steve Holmes of Iowa City. And Phil Krejci of Cedar Rapids writes, "Vote no, lose funding for your district." During the past 25 years, members of Congress have devoted much of their time to fighting legislation proposed by the other party, even if that legislation would benefit their district. Results have become unimportant because there are so few. The process has taken priority. The rationale mouthed by members for opposing legislation simply because it was proposed by the other party has been that the legislation included things that are contrary to their principles. Members of Congress who oppose legislation because of their principles should be rewarded for their principled stand by being denied funding for their district from the legislation they opposed. Such a rule would relieve members of the terrible burden of hypocrisy and shame they bear after voting no on legislation and then seeking money from it. Such a rule could have many benefits. First, it might inspire members to propose amendments to legislation and they oppose on principle, and, if their amendments are passed, their principles would be vindicated. But that would require members to do some work rather than simply voting no on legislation. Second, it could lead to more partisanship and cooperation in Congress. More bipartisanship. If members knew they could not get funding from legislation they opposed and they needed funding from it for their district, they might work more for their district than their party. Third, if members were denied funds for their district from legislation they opposed, voters would have valuable information to use in the next election. Phil Krejci of Cedar Rapids. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, November 20th, 2022, on the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service, and I am your reader, Sharon Falduto. We turn to today's obituaries. Norma Jean Andresen, age 86, of Keystone, died Friday, November 18th, Phillips Funeral Home of Keystone handling arrangements. Frank E. Prochaska, age 92, a resident of Cottage Grove Place in Cedar Rapids, passed away there on Sunday, November 13th. A celebration of Frank's life will be held at a future date. Papage Cuba Funeral Service is serving the family. Following high school, Frank served in the U.S. Navy. He had a successful career with Northwestern Bell U.S. West for 36 years, retiring in 1986. He was a member of Aldergate United Methodist Church. Marilyn K. Moore Boots, age 69, of Center Point, passed away October 30th from a courageous battle with cancer. Marilyn enjoyed holidays with her family and spending time with her great-grandbabies. No services listed. Douglas James Tracta, 75, of Center Point, died November 17th at the Dennis and Donna Oldorf Hospice House of Mercy. Celebration of life services will be held at a later date. Brosh Chapel and the Ava Center in Cedar Rapids are caring for Douglas and his arrangements. Douglas enlisted in the U.S. Air Force, where he served two terms in the Vietnam War. Doug owned and operated Tracta Unlimited for many years until working as a security officer at the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library in West Branch for over 12 years. He enjoyed fishing, making candy, hunting, target shooting, and going to car shows. Claire J. Sharp, 82, of Cedar Rapids, went to the Lord on Thursday, November 17th. A visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Monday, November 21st, with a prayer service beginning at 3 p.m. at Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Cedar Rapids. Funeral Mass will take place at 10 a.m. Tuesday, November 22nd at St. Jude Catholic Church in Cedar Rapids, with a visitation 1 hour prior. Burial will follow at St. Joseph Cemetery in Cedar Rapids. A luncheon will follow burial at St. Jude Catholic Church in Parish Hall. Claire had a servant's heart and was deeply passionate in carrying out the Lord's calling with a lifetime of volunteerism. She was actively involved in a bright, familiar face at St. Jude Catholic Church, serving as Eucharistic minister, Grateful Grannies, funeral dinner assistant, and was the initial co-founder of the St. Jude's Sweet Corn Festival, which started in 1975. She loved volunteering at Mercy Medical Center for over 48 years, and she always noted she was a Mercy girl. She helped with Mercy Catherine's Cupboard, Writers Club, and was a consistent Red Cross blood donor. She enjoyed reading, crossword puzzles, card games, Wordle, and was an avid sports fan. She also had a green thumb and was a huge Elvis fan. A joint celebration of life for daughters/sisters Janet Ann and Diane Marie Wheeler will be held on November 25th at the Blairstown, Iowa Community Center, 305 Locust Street. Friends may drop by to visit with the family from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. Bernice Grundmeier, 92, a longtime resident of Lamont, passed away peacefully on November 15th. She married Willis Grundmeier, and they farmed in northeast Iowa all their lives. A mass of Christian burial will be 10 a.m. Saturday, November 26th at St. Mary Catholic Church in Strawberry Point, with the Reverend John Hogan presiding. Visitation, 3 to 7 p.m. Friday, November 25th at Leonard Muller Funeral Home in Strawberry Point, followed by a 7 p.m. rosary. Friends may also call 1 hour before the service at the church on Saturday. Interment, St. Albert's Catholic Cemetery in rural Lamont. Donovan Hoffman, known as Don, age 72 of Springville, passed away on Thursday, November 17th at Mercy Medical Center in Cedar Rapids. A celebration of life will be held from 2 to 5 p.m. Saturday, November 26th at Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Marion. The family requests that everyone dress casually, as Don did not like to dress up. Don worked for PMX before retiring in 2012. He loved his Harley and boathouse and enjoyed sitting on the porch. He had a quick wit and some of the best one-liners. Anna Lee Machasek, known as Annie, age 86 of Solon, died Wednesday, November 16th at the Solon Retirement Village. Visitation will be 4 to 7 p.m. Tuesday, November 22nd at Brosh Chapel in the Ava Center in Cedar Rapids, 2121 Bowling Street Southwest. A celebration of life service will be 10:30 a.m. Wednesday, November 23rd at the Shoeyville United Methodist Church, with burial to follow in Oakland Cemetery in Solon. Before farming with Milo in the Ely area for most of their lives, she worked at Collins Radio from 1955 to 1960. In her earlier years, she enjoyed playing sports, gardening, going to dances and celebrations, caring for her farm pets, making a yearly shopping trip to Davenport, going to casinos, baking, and making Christmas candy. The past few years, she really enjoyed going to church, listening to the Sunday morning polka party, reading her Bible, mending, watching the Iowa Hawkeyes play basketball, talking Czech, and communicating with friends and family. Joel Andrew Baumgartner, 64, of Strawberry Point, passed away on Thursday, November 17th at St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids, surrounded by family. Funeral service, 10:30 a.m. Wednesday, November 23rd at St. Sebald Lutheran Church in rural Strawberry Point, with Pastor Margaret Yackel-Julien officiating. Visitation, 3 to 7 p.m. Tuesday, November 22nd at Leonard Muller Funeral Home in Strawberry Point. Friends may also call 1 hour before the service at the church on Wednesday. Interment, St. Sebald Lutheran Cemetery in rural Strawberry Point. Aletha Mae Fox, age 66, from Toddville, died from a long-term illness Sunday, October 23rd at Mercy Hospital in Cedar Rapids. Cremation services were provided through Iowa Cremation. A celebration of life services will be held at a later date. Aletha enjoyed spending time with friends and family, fishing, and being outdoors with her dogs. She was a free spirit and always willing to stand up for things she believed in and the rights of others. Aletha was an avid fan of the Green Bay Packers and the Iowa Hawkeyes. Her final day was spent with family, friends, and her dog. Connie O'Mara, born Connie Fimbo, age 86 of Northfield, Minnesota, formerly of Des Moines and Sergeant Bluff, passed away November 8th. A celebration of Connie's life is being planned for summer 2023. Lloyd L. Muller, age 81, of Dubuque, formerly of Center Point, died Wednesday, November 16th, at his home, surrounded by his wife and children. Visitation will be from 9:30 to 10:30 a.m. Monday, December 19th, at Hoffman, Schneider, and Kitchen Funeral Home and Crematory. The funeral service for Lloyd will be 10:30 a.m. Monday, December 19th, at Hoffman, Schneider, and Kitchen Funeral Home and Crematory, with the Reverend Diane Grace officiating. Burial will be in Limmed Cemetery in Dubuque. Full military honors will be rendered by the American Legion Post 6 and Iowa Army National Guard. Lloyd was a veteran proudly serving our country in the U.S. Air Force, U.S. Navy, and U.S. Army. His career at the telephone company was a lengthy one as an inside technician for 33 years. He was a longtime member of St. John's Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod in Center Point. When he was not working or mowing his lawn, he enjoyed fishing, hunting, traveling, and visiting with his family and friends. He will be remembered by his children for always working hard through his retirement. Even though his retirement was interrupted by Parkinson's, he faced it with bravery and remained hopeful a cure could be found. Joanne Marie Henderson, 77, went home to Jesus on Sunday, November 13th, after a recent diagnosis of ovarian cancer. A rosary will be held at 8:30 a.m. Saturday, November 26th, at St. Boniface Catholic Church in Waukee, followed by Memorial Mass at 9 a.m. Interment will be at Boonville Cemetery in Boonville, Iowa. The family will receive friends at a luncheon at the church immediately following the interment. Joanne enjoyed gardening, reading, playing piano, and listening to music. She was active at St. Boniface Church, where she served as a communion minister to the sick and homebound, as a first communion catechist of second graders, and as a support for veterans and their families. On the sports page, My Kloss writes, "That's incredible, not just an old TV show. Hawkeyes win again despite giving up 263 yards to Muhammad Ibrahim in Minneapolis. Kind of incredible. The strangest season in Iowa football history is now one that could be a championship season. The previous week, Iowa gained a measly 146 total yards and still beat Wisconsin 24-10. Saturday, while playing on the cold, hard road, the Hawkeyes allowed a running back to gain 263 yards. They still somehow defeated Minnesota 13-10. First, it was a chip shot field goal by Michigan to beat Illinois with 9 seconds left Saturday to swing open the door for Iowa to represent the Big Ten West in Indianapolis in 2 weeks. It was Illinois' fourth league loss. Then Iowa's Drew Stevens made a 21-yarder with 28 seconds remaining, and the Hawkeyes squeezed out their 4th straight victory after their West title dreams had once seemed comatose. The Hawkeyes and Purdue are 5-3 atop the West, and Iowa has the tiebreaker. After getting run over but not crushed by the Gophers' Muhammad Ibrahim, who rushed 39 times for 263 yards. How many teams have allowed someone to rush for that much and won? Iowa doesn't know, doesn't care. It survived. It advanced to the Black Friday extravaganza against Nebraska with something big on the line, and it kept a big metal pig for an 8th straight year. Floyd of Rosedale only visited this Minneapolis icebox for a few hours. He's going back to Iowa City. What a nutty game. In the first half, it felt like Iowa had applied an armbar on the verge of being converted into a full Nelson. Iowa led 10-0 after one quarter, had put the clamps on star Gopher running back Muhammad Ibrahim, and was playing yet another West foe with a half-baked passing game. Minnesota bounced back with a 72-yard touchdown drive, fueled by 3 straight Athan Kalikimakis completions for a total of 48 yards. They came 2 plays after the freshman left the game and made a beeline for the medical tent. Was he concussed? No. Maybe something in the tent warmed his arm. Maybe Ibrahim found leg warmers in the second quarter. He ripped off a 35-yard run on a drive stopped at the Iowa 16 with a missed field goal, then tore away 54 yards on the Gophers' first second-half drive. That one did produce a field goal. Hawkeye cornerback Cooper DeJean outraced Ibrahim to stop him from a go-ahead touchdown. It was 10-10 with momentum and an All-American-to-be-veteran running back on Minnesota's side. Iowa had no Sam Laporta, the tight end who basically was his team's receiving core, and quarterback Spencer Petras' safety blanket until Laporta's 4th first-half reception when he was injured. Injuries happen, and Minnesota lost left offensive tackle Ariante Ersery with 1 in the 3rd quarter. So the clash rolled into the 4th quarter, still knotted at 10, and Iowa with the wind at its back. Who would crack, and who would do the cracking? DeJean's 16-yard punt return in the late in the 3rd quarter started Iowa at its 37, and 1 play later it was the final period. The wind was at the Hawkeyes' backs, but DeJean's setup didn't lead to any points, and Iowa punted. DeJean tackled freshman Gopher punt returner Quentin Redding at the Minnesota 3 after Redding made the bad decision to return Torrey Taylor's boomer. That didn't lead to the Hawkeyes pinning Minnesota deep. The Gophers rushed their way to the Iowa 9. The 10th of Ibrahim's 10 consecutive carries on the 88-yard, 8:52 drive resulted in a lost fumble, courtesy of Iowa linebacker Jack Campbell with 5:09 left. The Hawkeyes' defense was chipped, but Ibrahim cracked on his 37th carry. Iowa went 3 and out at its 9. The Gophers then had a 3rd and 7 at the Iowa 33. Campbell, one of the best players ever to don a Hawkeye uniform, intercepted a pass and returned it 30 yards to the Minnesota 45 with 2:06 left. Spencer freaking Petras. The much-maligned quarterback threw a 33-yard pass to tight end Luke Lachey, and Stevens' short field goal for the win was the payoff 4 plays later. If Iowa beats Nebraska, it goes to Indianapolis. How? By a defense that was bowled over by Ibrahim but popped up to save the day, and by an offense that got it done on the drive it needed to get done. Kind of incredible? That's putting it mildly. Continuing on the sports page from News Notes, some news notes. In college wrestling, the Hawks topped the Bulls in New York. Number 2 Iowa improved to 4-0 with their 35-7 win over Buffalo on Friday night at the Arm Bar at the Armory. Iowa beat Sacred Heart 35-6 earlier Friday. They're getting better and you can see the timing come in, Iowa associate head coach Terry Brand said. The Hawkeyes won 8 matches against the Bulls, including technical fouls from Cullen Shriver, 133, Abe Assad, 184, and Jacob Warner, 197, and a pin from Tony Cassiope, 285. Woods withdraws from All-Star Classic in Iowa City. Iowa junior Rayal Woods has withdrawn from the NCAA All-Star Classic on Tuesday in Austin, Texas. He has taken the mat yet this season. Coach Tom Brand said this week he was day-to-day. Big 12 champion Andrew Elrez of Northern Colorado is taking his place. Two other Hawkeyes, Jacob Warner and Tony Cassiope, are still scheduled to participate in the event. Hawkeye women dominate at Open. 7 unattached Hawkeyes win a combined 24-0 on the first day of the Missouri Valley Open on Friday, outscoring their opponents 198-10. On Saturday, 5 Iowa wrestlers went on to win titles. Sterling Dallas, 101, Nyla Valencia, 109, Felicity Taylor, 116, Nanea Estrella, 136, and Reese Laramendi, 143. And 2 finished runner-up, Emil Gonzalez, 101, and Brianna Gonzalez, 109, to their teammates. In college volleyball, UNI and Drake take top MVC honors. Northern Iowa and Drake swept the top honors in the Missouri Valley Conference Volleyball Awards. Drake outside hitter Haley Bush was named the Player of the Year, and Drake setter Addison Beagle was named Freshman of the Year. UNI senior Sydney Peterson was Libero of the Year, and junior Taylor Alden was Setter of the Year. UNI coach Bobby Peterson was Coach of the Year, leading UNI to the regular season title. The MVC championships begin today at Meeks Family Fieldhouse in Evansville, Indiana. UNI is the top seed and Drake is number 2, and both don't play into the semifinals Tuesday. And in Iowans in the NFL, David Johnson signs with the Saints. Former UNI running back David Johnson was signed to the practice squad of the New Orleans Saints this week. Johnson, 31, previously played for the Cardinals in Texas. Saturday, he was elevated to the active roster. Turning to the time machine, a look back at people, places, and events in eastern Iowa, Playtime Poppy. Happy Little Ear of Corn has been entertaining children in Cedar Rapids since 1952, by Diane Fannin Langton, correspondent. You know you're from Cedar Rapids if you know who Playtime Poppy is. The beloved Ear of Corn mascot, who has her own song and a devoted following among the younger set, appears in every performance of the Playtime Poppy Children's Theater productions held in Cedar Rapids High School auditoriums with student actors. If you've never been to one of the shows, Beauty and the Beast is being staged in December at Kennedy High School. Poppy made her first appearance in 1952, but her story begins with the founding of the Junior Service League in Cedar Rapids in 1929. The organization became affiliated with the Association of Junior Leagues of America in 1934. Junior League members were interested in children's theater and produced their first children's play, The Sleeping Beauty, on April 13, 1937. The play had adult actors and was performed for junior high and grade school students at Roosevelt High School, followed by performances at Wilson, McKinley, and Franklin schools, and then at the Children's Hospital in Iowa City. Productions were suspended during World War II, resuming in March 1947, when The Tinderbox was performed 3 times on a Saturday morning at the Paramount Theater for children in public and parochial schools. In 1951, League member Mary Jane Morgan formally organized the Cedar Rapids Children's Theater, Inc., with a 28-member board of Junior League and community members. Morgan then dreamed up the Playtime Poppy character. The mascot was drawn by Margaret Van Dyke Collins and her costume sewn by Janet Rapp. Posters showing a smiling ear of corn were handed out to school kids with a message, "Hi kids, I'm Playtime Poppy. You'll be hearing from me soon." Playtime Poppy's big reveal was set for Saturday, October 11th. But children somehow thought Poppy would be on the radio Friday, October 10th. There was no school that day, so kids and their parents gathered at KCRG Radio at 1st Street and 1st Avenue Southwest, hoping to meet the mascot. The lobby was jammed, the phones were ringing, with youngsters asking a bewildered switchboard operator where Playtime Poppy was. She hadn't heard of the mascot, the Gazette reported in its Around the Town column. The mix-up was straightened out, and the kids learned they'd have to wait till Saturday to meet Poppy. The children's theater directors were gratified over the tremendous interest they had created in their new venture, the Gazette reported. Playtime Poppy's first time on stage came October 25, 1952, when the Edwin Strawbridge Ballet of New York presented Hans Christian Andersen's Prince Swineherd at Coe College's Sinclair Auditorium. Lady Make-Believe, Mrs. Fred Glanville, told the children Poppy's backstory. Poppy was once a small ear of corn in a cornfield near Cedar Rapids and wanted to attend the theater. When the load of corn was shipped to Cedar Rapids, Playtime Poppy jumped out and found the way to the public library, where children's theater headquarters are located. When asked to become the mascot, Playtime Poppy accepted. Poppy's first year included appearances during each production's intermission and in the city's Christmas parade. The Playtime Poppy song, About a Happy Little Ear of Corn, was written in 1955 by Mrs. Jack Voorhees, a junior league member. In 1973, students from the three Cedar Rapids high schools began presenting the plays. Kennedy was first with No Small Thing, followed by Androcles and the Lion at Jefferson and The Secret World of Og by Washington. By 1980, Poppy had the wide-eyed look and big puffy kernels that most Cedar Rapidians associate with a mascot. When the Martin's department store basement, full of the children's theater costume and props, was declared a fire hazard in 1991, the items were divided among the three high schools and Mount Mercy College. Leftovers were sent to Goodwill. But Playtime Poppy and her song live on. And that brings me to the end of reading the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, November 20th, 2022. I've been your reader, Sharon Falduto, reading to you from my kitchen table in Coralville. Remember that you can access a recording of this or any other Iris recording anytime on our website, iowaradioreading.org. We welcome your comments. Thank you for listening.